Welcome to From the Magazine, a podcast of Holiness Today, where you will hear from our authors and editors about everyday faith.
Welcome to a special edition podcast episode of the 30th General Assembly. Earlier today, we recorded Sam Barber's workshop, John Wesley, and Discipleship.
Well, we could just awkwardly stare at each other for a while, but we might as well think about getting started, maybe just a little bit early. Preachers have a chronic disease of not being able to tell time. I'm a preacher, and so I'd hate for us to not have an opportunity maybe at the end to ask a couple of questions. So I'm very grateful that you are here. You've already relieved me of a fear I had, which was me and my wife and maybe one other. So thank you for coming. My name is Sam, and I would like to talk to you today about this concept of what in the world would John Wesley from 18th century England have to say to us in 21st century United States and Canada largely, but other parts of the world, that would matter. What in the world is it that he said or did that is in any way relevant? I had 50 copies of a covenant. If you were one of the first 50 here, you got one. If you didn't, let me just go over real quickly. These are the resources. If you happen to use the Foundry and get the pastor's resources, the leader's guide that you can download, I just downloaded and printed them out in part because I wanted to see what they looked like. The back of that is also the covenant. So that's available to you. We're going to talk about that covenant later. It'll make more sense, I hope, then. There's also a student guide. So everybody who would be a part of, if you decided to do this at your church, would receive a very basic one-page student guide for each time you work through the material. And then, of course, there are some sermon outlines written by a mysterious person that I don't know. So I never did find out who wrote the sermons, but that's fine. And they're here available for you from the downloadable People of Grace stuff from the Foundry. There's also some social media posts if you need help writing posts that are, you know, positive and encouraging about this subject. They're right there, and you can copy them from that. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started. Thank you again for coming. And we're going to talk about a People of Grace, Wesley's discipleship for today's Nazarenes. I want to start with a couple of stories. There was a guy named Bob who attended my church many years ago. In fact, just about 20 years ago. And Bob stood out in our local congregation because Bob was an ex-con, and you could tell. We had a pretty suburban white congregation. Bob had very long hair, tattoos, and a little bit of an attitude. He would disappear frequently, which were smoke breaks. But Bob and I became good friends. Bob liked to ride a motorcycle, so did I, and so most of the time we worked on his motorcycle. Occasionally we rode together, and we loved this taco truck in our town. And so one day over tacos, I want to tell you what Bob said to me. Bob said, "Sam, I like your church, and your sermons aren't that bad. But I want to tell you," he said, "the reason why I am sober. It's because I know that there are 12 people who would physically restrain me if I decided to drink and drug again." 20 years ago, long before I was really even having thoughts about anything that I'm thinking about today, but I never forgot it. I have a friend, her name is Debbie. She and her daughter have decided that they're going to get fit. And this time, they're really going to do it, right? The thing that's unique this time is that they've signed up in some sort of arrangement with a trainer, and the trainer actually calls them or texts them to say, "How are you doing? I noticed you did this. What if you tried this?" And they report that they're doing better than ever. I have a friend named Cheryl, and Cheryl is a Weight Watchers coach. Her job is to journey alongside several people who are working through the weight loss journey. She's part of her role is to call them, to meet with them, to help them during those awkward weigh-in moments, to go through all of that with them and to be there for them. And when I received the opportunity to work on this material, it came with a deadline from the Foundry. And when I saw the deadline, I thought, that's a misprint. And I realized if I'm going to be able to accomplish this, I'm going to need some help. So I have a life coach that I've worked with at various times. I said, do you do stuff like this? He said, every Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock, we'll meet. I'll give you some strategies. You check in and tell me how it's going. Would you believe I finished ahead of schedule? All four of those stories have something in common. And what they have in common is what I want to talk to you about today. I want to tell you that the thing that they have in common, the single thing that all four stories have in common, is the difference maker in each of those accounts. It's the difference between sobriety and relapse. It's the difference between weight loss and something else. It's the difference between my deadline, and it's the difference between being fit or not being fit. I also want to tell you that this one thing that they all have in common is not new and it's not fancy. So if you came to the seminar today thinking we're going to hear something we've never heard about before, I'll close my eyes and quietly you can just go. All right, good. No, bar the door. Don't let them out. The other thing I want to tell you about this thing that is common to all four of those stories is that it is absolutely biblical and absolutely a part of Christian history. And the last thing I want to tell you about those four stories, the one thing that they all have in common, is that that thing has, regrettably, been largely abandoned by the church, but picked up by our culture. And they're teaching us something. That thing, you probably already know, but if you don't, I'll tell you. Accountability. And this is the part where you say, oh, was that it? Well, I'll see you guys later. I know it doesn't sound fancy, and it isn't. And it's not very exciting, but hold on. Alcoholics Anonymous, Weight Watchers, CrossFit, higher education, cohort business practices, all of these places in our culture and many, many, many more have rediscovered the power of accountability. And I want to suggest to you today that it's time that the church goes back and takes back what was ours from the beginning. Really, it's everyone's, but something that we used to practice. It seems like the culture has discovered this. If I really want to change this time, I'm going to need some people to help me. Now, as you're just beginning to let these thoughts sink in, think about your Christian life. Isn't it true? You don't have to raise your hands. You don't even have to agree. But most of my life, I've heard that my role was to have a personal relationship with Jesus. And that's so true. Absolutely. Every person must make a decision. But what unfortunately happened is that we kind of thought that meant private. And so we make new resolutions. We make new commitments. And we think to ourselves, this time I'm really going to do it. And oftentimes we fail, and that's too bad. So here's the bottom line of this workshop. I'm convinced that accountability in a loving and vulnerable environment, accountability in a loving and vulnerable environment is the key to discipleship. You don't have to agree yet, but I hope to convince you by the time we're done. Here's a working definition, because when we say discipleship, it means like probably every one of us would write down a different definition. So I want to tell you what I'm thinking and how I'm thinking about it and talking about it today. Think of three things. Here's the things. Be, make, church. B. Jesus walked along the seashore and found some guys who were fishermen, and he said, come and do what? Follow me. And that requirement or that question from Jesus was not just for those fishermen. It extends all the way to us, doesn't it? And everyone who will ever walk on this planet. Come and follow me. So part of discipleship is being a disciple. You could ask yourself right now, I wonder how I'm doing at being a follower of Jesus. Then Jesus, that's Matthew 4, by the way. Matthew 28, very clearly, if you're in a discipleship thing, probably you've heard about the Great Commission. Matthew 28, 19 and 20, all authority in heaven and earth. You know where I'm headed? Therefore, what? Go and make disciples. Okay? Being, follow me, make, go and make disciples. And then the church. And you're like, oh, you got me there. What is the purpose of the church? I think the purpose of the church is to do what Jesus had been doing, to carry on the work of Jesus. So Acts chapter 1, verse 8, when Jesus says, you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you and you will be my witnesses. What's he saying? I want you to go and do what I've been doing. So when I'm talking about discipleship, I'm talking about your personal relationship with Jesus and the way that you are following him. I'm talking about how you are answering the call of the Great Commission, and I'm talking about what your church is for. Someone wiser than me said, the purpose of the church is to make disciples, and disciples are God's gift to the world. I like that. Here's a little summary so far. If we want to be disciples and make disciples, and if we want our churches to fulfill the purpose Jesus intended, we will need to rediscover accountability in a loving and vulnerable environment. If you're skeptical, it's okay. Let me go on. Let me set some expectations for this workshop, because I know when you come to a workshop, you're thinking to yourself, I wonder how long this is going to last. Is it going to be worth it? I'm going to give you four chunks of this workshop so you'll know if we're halfway through when we're at the second one, okay? Probably everyone who's present has at one time or another visited a doctor. So I want you to think about the visit that you had to the doctor. And there were some things that happened. One, there was a presenting problem. You were thinking to yourself, I'm concerned about this. My arm hurts, my leg hurts, my blood pressure's high, I've got a headache, whatever it is. The presenting problem. Second thing, the diagnosis. This is where the doctor says, tell me more, or let's have a look. Third, the treatment plan. I didn't know what else to write, so I said, take two of these and call me in the morning. And finally, prognosis. You're going to get better, or here's what it's going to look like when you are better. So this talk is going to be broken into these four things. We're going to talk about discipleship and its presenting problem. We're going to talk about a diagnosis for that presenting problem, a treatment plan for that presenting problem, and then a prognosis. So that's the way this is going to go. I'm convinced, I really am convinced of this, that when we say and find in one, our own souls, and two, in our hearts, this longing for revival, I want to suggest to you today, at the outset of this, that while that may look like something that happens in the sanctuary during a worship service, it also might very well be the recovery of loving accountability in a vulnerable environment where God decides to pour out His Spirit on people who are in search of a holy life. In other words, I'm suggesting that revival may come through discipleship. And we'll see. This is a good discipleship crowd. You're saying amen to that stuff. Most of the time, people look at me and they're like, presenting problem. What is the presenting problem of our discussion today? Well, there are some things that Jesus said that I struggle with. For instance, when Jesus is talking and he says, the wind blows wherever it pleases. And I'm like, I wish I knew exactly what you meant, Jesus. There are sometimes Jesus says things and I'm confused. We all right? And then there are other times, everybody okay? Then there are other times that Jesus says things that are very clear. For instance, the Great Commission is straightforward, right? It's pretty hard not to understand that Jesus is saying, go and make disciples. The things that he's not clear on, I struggle with, but we can be clear on that. Jesus was very clear that he wants us to follow him. He's very clear that he wants us to make disciples. And he's very clear that he's going to empower the church to continue the work that he'd been doing. Be, make, church. Be, make, church. Remember those? Here's what I'm concerned about. This is my presenting problem. The church is very good at many things. We are not particularly good right now at making disciples. This is how I feel about most of my personal and pastoral discipleship efforts. Like I tripped on something and smashed my face. That image is going to be there for a while, so enjoy. Now, I want to tell you something else. It's possible that you might be feeling already a little bit of guilt, and I'm not trying to give you that. I gathered a group of people at a local church and said, let's talk about discipleship. A man stood up. He said, I've been a Christian all of my life. I'm 55 years old, and I've never made a disciple. And the room went still because everybody in the room thought, yeah, me either. Me either. I was going through this with my mother-in-law because she was a captive audience. And I got all the way done. And I'm telling you, she is the greatest. She's a leading layperson in her church. She's been on her church board. She's been on the district advisory board. She's a Sunday school teacher. And she said, I feel a little bit guilty. And I said, hold on, that's not what I want. So I want to tell you this. I'm going to say some things that sound a little bit hard to hear. But it is true that many of the things that you are doing and many of the things that the church is doing, those things are contributing to the cause of discipleship for sure. But I think there's room for improvement. And that's what I want to talk with you about today. Here's why I think that. In the past 50 years, church attendance has shrunk by at least 21%. We have a few seats down here if you guys want to, if you don't mind. It's like the third, it's like the center seat in the Southwest Airlines. If you want a chair, there's a few down here. You can come on down. Sincerely, you can arm wrestle for them. Okay, back to the stats. In the past 50 years, church attendance has, they'll be fine. They know how to sit down. Church attendance has shrunk by 21%. Guess how far discipleship attendance has shrunk in the same period? 29% or more. Probably a little bit more. My statistics were from about 2020, so a lot's changed in that time. Of those people in our congregations who attend church, now remember, this may not be true in your local church, but generally, of people who attend our church is 1 in 10. 1 out of 10 also are in a discipleship setting. 1 out of 10. Here's the one that chills me. George Barna says, there is statistically no significant difference between the lifestyle choices of those who attend our churches and those who don't. What you might be thinking is, well, surely the Nazarenes are exempt. Some of you are pastors and discipleship folk. You know it's not true. Let me reinforce it just a little bit. Anyone want to take a guess at the decade when the discipleship numbers in the Church of the Nazarene peaked? What decade? 1970s. Very good. Gold stars for everyone. 10,000 Jesus points for all of you. Since then, we have been in a steady decline, except for the year 2009, also a General Assembly year, also an SDMI convention year. Do you know what happened in 2009? We said, you can count your small groups and your discipleship numbers. You know what happened after that? Same decline. Anyone want to take a guess at where our discipleship numbers are today when compared to where they've been historically? It's a terrible question, let me just tell you. Our numbers today in the United States and Canada in discipleship are nearly the same numbers as they were in 1953. That means that for 70 years, we've been in decline. This is astonishing to me. In part, now remember, I've been a pastor my whole life, so I'm not blaming you. I'm blaming me. I'm saying, what was I doing all these years? The astonishing thing to me is that we know what Jesus said in the Great Commission, right? That's not hard to understand. The wind blows wherever it pleases. I don't know what he meant. But on that one, Jesus was very clear, go make disciples. And also, you are a part of a denomination who has a mission statement, which is do what? Make Christ-like, 10,000 Jesus points for you. Make Christ-like disciples in the nations, and yet for 70 years. So, I want to suggest that it's a good time to take a serious look at our discipleship plans, personally, and in our churches. So, in summary, here's our presenting problem. We are failing at something Jesus was explicit about, being and making disciples. Okay? That's one done. Aren't you glad? Let's move on. The diagnosis. Let's have a look. Discipleship is challenging. Do you know what that is? That is a 1980s Beta. Shout out. VCR. How many of you had a Beta VCR in the 80s? We did, because we're cutting edge, and that's going to really catch on. I mean, we were irrelevant in like 10 minutes, even in the 80s. Here's the thing. Here's the reason it's up there. This right here. The clock on the VCR was mysterious. The idea, the promise was, if you can keep that clock set, you can record your television shows because then you can watch a show when you want to. All of the like young people in the room are like, what? So the point is essentially this. The clock setting on those things was so fiddly that everybody's house we went to, people had just given up, and it was just blinking 12 o'clock. You know what I'm talking about? Discipleship is like this because it's not, the concept of making disciples isn't difficult to understand, but it's pretty tough to accomplish. I'm going to talk to you about why it's difficult, But think about this. In the English language, the word disciple is really close to the word discipline, and there is something about that that is a correlation, yes? There's a part of discipleship that requires us to do things that aren't particularly comfortable. Also, particularly in churches like ours, there's been this separation between conversion and discipleship. Like, you can become a Christian, and if you're really into it, you should make disciples. The Bible makes no such distinction, ever. I have a friend, his name is Bill Hall. He's also a kind of a famous author from a little while ago, and he wrote a book called Conversion and Discipleship. You can't have one without the other. Pretty great concept. And Jesus' call to self-denial and following doesn't initially look that great, right? I think if I would have been one of the disciples and Jesus is like, if you want to follow me, you need to deny yourself and take up your cross. And I've been like, whoa. That does not tweet. Like, we can't do that, Jesus. You got to come at it another way. But Jesus is intent on saying that. In Matthew chapter 7, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, if you want to follow me, essentially, there's going to be a very narrow path and a small gate. You should enter there. And Jesus also says, the culture, however, has found a wide gate and a giant path, and everybody wants to go that way. The reason this megaphone is on the screen is, if you decide that the wide entry and the place that everyone wants to be and the things that everyone wants to do, if that's what you like, just recognize you may enter here, but in the end, life's going to squeeze you out, and there's a bunch of you who know that's true, isn't it? How many people have you seen who have taken the easy road, and by the end of their life, they're squeezed out? Jesus says instead, no. Deny yourself. Take up your cross. And in the end, life opens up. Yeah? So this call to discipleship may not look particularly easy, but is the best. And here's the best part of all of that. God has given grace through the Holy Spirit for this thing to be accomplished. But I want to tell you what we're up against. I'll try to go through these quickly. If you want to pay more attention to them, they're in the book. By the way, someone remind me, Coach?
Yes, I will do that.
Remind me to give books away at the end.
Yeah.
Thank you. This is one of my old college basketball coaches. And he's like, we're the same age, so it's incredible. What are we up against? Postmodern mindset. I want to tell you, I'm borrowing from a speech I heard Dr. Busick give. Let me just hit you with a few of these. By the way, huge topic. Entire things could be written and said about it, but we want to hit it right now if we can. Postmodern mindset. Many people lack even the basic knowledge of the gospel of Jesus Christ. This is the world you live in. You know this. Most people lack even a basic knowledge of the gospel of Jesus Christ. They believe, perhaps, that Jesus was a good man. Some of them even that he might have been a prophet, but not God in human form. That's the world we live in. 72% of Americans deny the existence of absolute truth. Will you let that number sink in for just a minute? 72%. It's like there is no absolute truth. 50% watch the Super Bowl and see the guy with the John 3:16 sign behind the uprights. They have no idea what that means. Now, hopefully they Google it and find out, but that doesn't compute. It doesn't matter. That's not a part of their mindset. And as you know, words like evangelism and evangelical, these are now words that are just, we don't use them because they're inflammatory. Postmodernism is way larger than that, but we'll move on for just a moment. That's one of the things that you're up against. That's why discipleship is challenging. A part of this diagnosis is, yeah, this must be difficult. Secularization, these will go much quicker. The church has lost its voice as an influence in the thought life of the culture. It's true, right? There used to be a culture that we were a part of that was generally, if you allow me to use the phrase, Judeo-Christian. People understood the basics. Not anymore. Privatization. There is a chasm between public and private in the culture, and spiritual things are always put where? In the private. The famous phrase, you do you. Right? If you're about that, great. What you do in your private world is your own thing. Finally, pluralization, actually there's two. That's why I paused. There's one more after this. Pluralization means, and you know this is true, we are confronted with a staggering number of ideologies and faith options. You're one more in a long line of options for people. And finally, the last one, and I'd love to spend a ton of time on this. And by the way, there are a ton of other isms that I do not mention. You know some of them, nationalism and others. That's not a part of this, but it could be very easily. Consumerism. Here's a definition. The pervasive belief that increasing acquisitions of goods and services purchased in the marketplace is, ready, always a desirable goal and increases well-being and happiness. If you just get, you remember the phrase, he who or she who dies with the most toys wins? That's consumerism in a nutshell. I read a great book called Affluenza. You can read it too, and you should. It's amazing. Here's a quote. This blew my mind. America's 114 million households, it's hard to even imagine, but 114 million households in America contain and consume more stuff than all other households throughout history put together. I'm one of them. They go on to say, behind closed doors, we churn through manufactured goods and piped in entertainment as if life were a stuff-eating contest. And despite tangible indications of indigestions, we keep consuming, partly because we're convinced it's normal. It's the world we live in. In fact, this is the water we swim in. So when we start talking about denying ourselves and taking up our crosses, people look at us like we're crazy. That's not the world they live in. It's no wonder discipleship is so difficult. So here's the diagnosis. I tried to write this like when I go to my chart after seeing my doctor, and he says, you can go there and find out the results of your test. I don't understand those words, but anyway, here's what it says. Here's our diagnosis. We have a severe case of postmodernity with complications arising from ideological confusion and overconsumption. Doesn't that sound like the thing on your my chart? Treatment plan. We're past halfway. Take two of these and call me in the morning, so to speak. I want to offer to us today, as I've already intimated earlier, an ancient remedy for our postmodern ailment. Okay? So an old answer to our new-ish problem. So we could begin with the question, how are disciples made? But I think a better question might be, how were disciples made? Jesus and the 12 is our best example, yeah? Jesus invented the whole thing. Jesus and the 12, their relationship was, well, that's redundant, but highly relational. What I mean is they connected at every level. Imagine a 3-year camp out with Jesus. That's what we're talking about. They're walking, talking, sleeping, laughing, crying, fighting, highly vulnerable. There weren't any secrets on the camp out with Jesus. And highly accountable. If you want to put a disciple's name with each of those, if this helps you, maybe relational, we would put John, the one whom Jesus loved, the beloved. Highly vulnerable, we might put Thomas. Hey, Thomas, you missed Resurrection Church. You're a week later, but here, touch my hands inside, my hands and my side. Highly accountable, we probably have to talk about Simon Peter, right? Yep. 3 denials. Do you love me? Yep. Do you? Yes. Do you? What was the result? Personal transformation. The disciples go from being the kinds of people who are often overlooked by their culture, maybe not chosen to be a part of the cool stuff that rabbis did, to becoming leaders of a movement that has changed the course of human history, yeah? And so the world impact is, yes, they, those guys, and honestly, many women who don't get the kind of credit that they deserve in the text, changed the course of human history. Highly relational, highly vulnerable, highly accountable. Tough to replicate, I think you would agree. I want to talk about John Wesley now. Big leap, but maybe worth it. 18th century England, John Wesley is an Anglican pastor who experienced, as you know, the transforming power of the Holy Spirit. His heart was strangely warm. There we are, good. And he longed for everyone to have that experience. John Wesley was convinced that that was normative Christianity, that everyone could and should have that same experience. He was a relentless organizer. So all the time that we've spent, and justifiably so, on the theology of John Wesley, and I'm thrilled that we have, I'm calling for us to spend as much time on the methodology of John Wesley. He placed his converts immediately in smaller settings with the primary focus of helping them toward holiness of heart and life. Those groups centered around a list of questions in a covenant format, and they met weekly, hear me, for 1 hour. And John Wesley was not casual about the 1 hour. Don't bring food. Don't sing. Don't go over so-and-so's house. you come together for 1 hour and you work through this covenant and it will change your life. And all of you are like, I wish it was more exciting than that. I know you do. But it changed the course of these people's lives. Here's what Wesley said about it. He's talking now about the class meeting, and he said, they therefore united themselves in order to pray together, to receive the word of exhortation, and to watch over one another in love, that they might help each other to work out their salvation. That's his phrase for accountability. Watching over one another, if we stop there, it's creepy. In love. It's a difference maker, right? That's the Wesleyan part of it. Watching over one another in love. The simple, consistent, these words are chosen very carefully, please hear them. The simple and consistent accountability had astonishing transformational power. Remember, Alcoholics Anonymous, CrossFit, whatever else, where people allow themselves to be accountable to one another, it changes things. And the small accountability focus group was called the class meeting. Dwight Moody, 19th century revivalist, said this. His English wasn't perfect, but he said this. The Methodist class meetings are the best institutions for training converts the world ever saw. The best institutions for training converts. That means the most effective discipleship that we've seen in a while, Moody said, was the Methodist class meeting, watching over one another in love. It was a means of grace. What's that mean? It means essentially that God pours out his grace in a variety of ways, and that grace impacts us because that's what God does. God is constantly reaching out to you. He's constantly pouring out grace in your direction, not just your direction, but in the direction of everyone. God is constantly pouring out that grace, and it impacts us. And when in faith we respond to that, something happens in us. There is growth. There is change. There is transformation. That's the work of God. God initiated, and we respond to it. And a group built around loving accountability reinforced the changes in people's minds. In other words, it made those changes stick, finally. It's my friends who are working on their fitness and their trainers texting them and calling them and saying, here's what you can do. They're going, you know, I'm going to do it. It made it stick. So the same thing we did. John Wesley, the same thing we did with Jesus. Was John Wesley's class meeting highly relational? Yes. In fact, people were called on weekly. They were grouped geographically because then no cars, no mass transit. So they're talking about people that they could get to. In other words, your neighbors who lived near you and saw you at your best and your worst, those were the people that you were living in loving accountability with. Those people were watching out for you. And they were led by laypersons. If I were you and I were a pastor and I miss being a pastor, I would be thinking to myself, this might have a chance. Were they vulnerable? Yes. By the way, John Wesley first wanted to go from converts to what he called a band later. His questions were so heavy. People were like, whoa, 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 dude, back off. They were too much for a new convert. And so he almost backed into this class meeting idea. But you read John Wesley's class meeting covenant, it's a little direct for us. Did you know that Phineas Brazee was converted? And prior to his conversion, a Methodist preacher came into the store where he was working. And you know what his lead question was? Young man, what's the condition of your soul? And God was already at work in prevenient grace. And not long after that, not at the revival meeting, but at the small group after, Phineas Brazee gave his heart to Jesus. How about it? Was it highly accountable? Yes. Wesley called it watching over one another in love. So what was the result? Personal transformation. Listen, for once in history, people's lives changed. Wesley's primary focus, he didn't care about a big church. He didn't care about pleasing the bishop. All he cared about was holiness of heart and life for himself and others. And it worked. Regular people, eventually even coal miners and people who could barely read or couldn't read at all of those kinds of people began to come to faith in Christ, immediately put in a group like this, held accountable in a loving way, and their lives changed forever. Was there world impact? I'll try to explain this to you. I can give you those stats later, the reference later, but essentially there are historians who are now saying what happened in France in the French Revolution that was brought about by bloodshed, that level of change happened in England without bloodshed as the result of Wesley and the early Methodists. The secular historians who are just saying that preacher and those people changed this country. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I propose then today a 21st century class meeting for Nazarenes. I call it a covenant formation group. I don't care what you call it if you decide to do it. Make up your own name, but I do want to offer you some ways that you could go about it. So if I were to give you a treatment plan today, if I were to say to you, here's how you can tackle this in your local churches, I would say, take these two things and call me in the morning. Here's the first one and the second one. Take an educational component and an experiential component, and I'll explain those. I've got right here a couple of these books that they gave me to give away to you. The Foundry did a great job on this book, and I just want to talk you really quickly through the chapters, because if you are interested in anything that I'm saying today and you wish you could hear more, wow, what a statement, you can. So here are the chapters. The reach of grace. So we spend some time talking about the grace of God and how it's already at work. We talk about the point of grace. In other words, how come God's pouring out so much grace on you? Is just so you can sit around and be holy and one day fly off into heaven like an angel? Pretty sure there's something we're supposed to be doing now, right? What was that? Oh, yeah. Make disciples. What is a disciple? We define it even further. What are the challenges to this grace that's being poured out in discipleship? We talk about that even more. What are the means of grace? We talk about that. And then the practical grace of a covenant group. How you can practice loving accountability. Now, I want to tell you something else about this book. There are like 136 pages to read. It doesn't take long. It's big print. There aren't any pictures, but you can draw your own in that margin. If you're like me, sometimes the appendix is like, well, whatever. Please, please, please read the 136 pages and then give as much attention to the appendix, because that's where the covenant is and that's where the change happens in the lives of people, and explain how that happens. So would anyone like a free one of these? I saw your hand first, but just over your head. If I hit you, I'm really, really sorry. Nice catch. This guy right here. Jonathan Rich, Jill Barber, right there. Ordained elder in the Church of the Nazarene right now. In the very back, my brother. Yes, you. Yes, come. God bless you.
Thank you so much.
Brother. You're welcome. Yeah. And for you. One more? Yeah? Oh, I'm so sorry. Listen, they gave me five, but for the low, the low, low price. If you go over to the Foundry booth, you can pick them up there. And I think there's even some deals and some things to offer. But I got to get back to this or we're going to be here forever. So I showed you already the sermon guide. I showed you already the leader's guide and the teacher's guide. I was able to help out on the leader's guide and the teacher's guide. So they follow the book really, really well. And it will really help walk your congregation or your small group through that. And then, although there are six chapters, I would allow 7 to 8 weeks to do the educational component. Here's what I think. I think that it took me a long time to even come to the awareness that Wesley did some cool stuff and we should think about it. And I think that most of our pastors and most of our congregants don't know it. We shouldn't assume that everybody's like a Wesley scholar. They're not. Certainly I'm not either, but I did some reading. The point being, if we're really going to do this well, we need to teach ourselves and then the people that we're dealing with what this all means, why it's important, why the means of grace matter. We've got to get that in our heads and hearts. So the educational part is pretty important. And at the end of that educational part, so there are six chapters. Why did I say 7 to 8 weeks? You need to write a covenant, and that takes a little bit of time. I'll tell you about that now. The next part is the appendix of the book. This is the experiential component. And this is where, forgive the phrase, the magic happens. This is where the transformation happens. Because it's one thing to get it here. So after 5, 6, 7 weeks of here, 3 months of practice. Got real quiet. Everyone's like, whoa, 3 months, I'm out. I can't do it. Wesley said, and I want to suggest, and have practiced, 1 hour, once a week, don't sing, don't go over to nobody's house, don't bring food, you'll ruin it. 1 hour, work the covenant, not fancy, life-changing. Please hear me. I know it's going to be a tough sell. But there are some people in your church who are like my friend Roger, who said, I'm 55 years old and I've been in the church my whole life and I've never made a disciple. That's the persons you want to invite to this. This is where what you learn gets put into practice. This is where it gets grooves in your soul. This is where it really, really sticks. So find some people who are willing to stick with it. And I, pastors, if you're here today, if you'll challenge the people in your church, I believe that they will say, I'll step up on this issue. Because everyone has a soul ache. Everyone says to themselves in their private thoughts, I wish I were doing better at that thing Jesus was really clear about telling me to do. We got to help them. And in so doing, I think we can help to change the world. You're like, are you sure? It happened once. Could it happen again? I think so. So this part of the covenant lasts 3 months. And at the end of the 3 months, you might say, wow, that went so well. The things that we used to be having in this covenant, we don't need to work on those anymore. Let's rewrite our covenant and you stay together. It might be, this was a terrible experience. I don't ever want to do this again, and everyone leaves. It might be, wow, this was so powerful. Look, you could be a leader, and you could be a leader, and you could be a leader, and you could be a leader. Let's go. I don't know what will happen with it exactly in your context. Maybe nothing. But the framework is there to be a new-ish discipleship practice that could change the lives of people. It worked for Wesley. And I believe with this practice, it can work for us. So the covenant is the heart of it. So some of you have the covenant in a handout. This is a terrible slide, but it's the only way I could get it. I know you can't read that probably. This is a sample. So I want us to look at the sample, and then I want to talk to you about how it's customized. This is a sample made from the Covenants of Christian Conduct in our manual. You'll hear flavors of that went out throughout this. Knowing that Jesus Christ died that I might live in loving relationship with God now and eternally, I pledge myself to live as his disciple, seeking to become more like him and witnessing to the hope found only in him with the help of the Holy Spirit and in loving accountability to these fellow believers. I seek to love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength and my neighbor as myself. Here are the things that this hypothetical group has agreed to ask themselves every time they gather for 3 months. Not fancy. Sounds like it doesn't have any teeth. Oh, it's got teeth. I will worship each Sunday unless prevented. I will receive the sacrament of Holy Communion each month. I will pray each day privately and with family and friends. I will read and study the scriptures each day. I will return to Christ the first tenth of all I receive. I will spend 4 hours each month in service to my broader community in Jesus' name. When I am aware of injustices to others, I will not remain silent. I will obey the promptings of the Holy Spirit. I will not sin against God or neighbor. I will prayerfully care for my body and the world in which I live. I hereby make this commitment, trusting in the grace of God to give me the will and the strength to keep this covenant. So you get together with your group of people, and if I'm the leader and it's the five or six of us, I say, I'll go first. I missed church last Sunday, and I really didn't have a good reason, and I'm struggling a little bit, and I need you guys to pray for me. And you'd all say, we're going to pray for you. And I would work all the way through. I go first. Leader goes first. Most vulnerable person, leader. And then I say, Chris, did you make it to church last Sunday? And you answer, hey, Chris, how did it go with communion? Hey, Chris, all the way through. Now, this might be a great introductory covenant, but I want you to know that your covenant can be whatever you want it to be. You could have 5 questions that really get at it. And so what if you have someone in your group? I want to talk to you about the customization of this covenant. What if you have someone in your group who says, I drink too much. It's bad. And you're thinking to yourself, I don't drink at all and I don't struggle. So we kick that person out of the covenant group, right? Get out. No. You may not struggle in that particular area, but do you ever sort of self-medicate? Like spend a little bit too much time scrolling to help pass the time? Spend a little too much time shopping? Whatever. But there must be some way that you can realize, you know what, if we ask this question, when it's your turn, I know you're talking about drinking, and when it's my turn, I know I'm talking about shopping. And you can hold one another accountable. Person says, I struggle with reading the Bible, and you're like, I don't struggle with reading the Bible. I'm great at reading the Bible. I read the Bible through every year or whatever. Okay, good. How are we going to kick somebody out? No, we're going to say, But each of us wants to grow closer to Jesus Christ. So maybe we ask the question, how did it go this week in your daily practices that helped draw you closer to Christ? I know I'm talking about reading the Bible and that person's talking about something else, but the question is the same. Do you see what I'm saying? This is infinitely customizable. I would suggest that this is too many questions. If you have about 10 people, you're never going to get done in an hour, and it'll kill it. But if you could get that down to about 5 or 6 questions, the vulnerability and the loving accountability is the key. We gave it away. We let it slip through our fingers, and the culture has said, hey, this really works. What if we got it back? Last thing. Oh, we're doing good. The prognosis. So I know what you're thinking to yourself. Is that it? I mean, that's it? And then one of you might say in your head, anybody could do that. And my answer is, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Anybody can do this. One of the secrets of Wesley's class meeting was that there was no hierarchy involved. You might have the day laborer leading the group and his supervisor in the group. Isn't that beautiful? And for Wesley and for the Nazarenes, gender did not matter. And so you had women who were the leaders of their groups and their husbands were participants. This is something that we can take to our congregations. What can you expect if you decide that you will do this? This is a bold statement, but I've seen it happen, and I want to encourage you that it can and should happen. If you do this, you will become a disciple of Jesus. Virtuosos and star athletes, they know that repeated practice under the watchful eye of a teacher or coach results and makes them better. Yeah? Tiger Woods, at the peak of his game, had a coach. Someone to say, I know that felt good. It wasn't good. It's going to come back to haunt you later. You got a hitch in the swing. For believers, repeated practice of godliness under the loving accountability of others brings about holiness of heart and life. Friends, I know it's not fancy. I know that you're not wowed by this concept, but I'm telling you, it works. And if you can find the people who want to be holy, who want to be disciples, who make disciples, I would recommend this as a path. I'm excited this afternoon because I believe the prognosis is good. Does the church need renewal? It does, doesn't it? What if revival doesn't come in our worship services, but in our Jesus-style discipleship settings with other people of grace? I know what we mean, and I share that heart. Sorry, I share that heart. I long for revival. But what if it doesn't happen in the sanctuary, but in that little classroom over there? What if Wednesday night, whatever your midweek thing is, if you have one, becomes as important as Sunday morning? Do we need unity?
Of course.
If you say no, I don't know how to talk to you anymore. What if unity is built on holiness? It is. Do you know? Just remembered we were recording, but I'll say it this way. Part of the problem that we have had in the last few years is a discipleship failure. We've been discipled to all manner of things, but not in the way that Jesus and ultimately then John Wesley helped us to see in the pursuit of holiness in heart and life. Are we still Nazarenes called unto holiness? What if this is the process part of sanctification? What if this is the part where we say, I mean, you know, I'm gonna work on my holiness on purpose? I think it is. The Covenant Formation Group attempts to do for postmodern Nazarenes what the class meeting did for 18th century Methodists. We can become a people of grace. We can. I mean, in many senses, we already are. But this business of being the kinds of disciples that Jesus envisioned can happen in this way. The pathway to tomorrow's church renewal goes through the yesterdays of John Wesley's class meeting.
Thank you for listening to the Holiness Today podcast. If you enjoyed this production and wish to hear more, visit holinesstoday.org/podcast or find us on Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts.